There's a lot of subjects that Buddhist teachers who have only studied with other lay practitioners tend to avoid because the topics can be a little bit difficult to grasp unless you've had the opportunity to really study with some of the Theravadan monks that I've been really fortunate to sit with and converse with. And one of the topics I thought I'd talk about is tonight, shunyata, which you will never hear discussed in most Buddhist centers. It literally means emptiness. But it's actually a topic that the Buddha returned to over and over again. It's a very powerful idea. And the reason is that most of the time it's not taught in the States or in the West is because it's been really poorly translated. And as a result, it hasn't been that well understood. And it's only when you really get to hear it from people who've studied the concepts in the sort of monastic tradition that you sort of get a real sense of what this powerful term means and why it's interesting and why the Buddha talks about it so much and how it applies in our own life. So I'm going to give you that background. And so hopefully in the future, when you hear it used or you consider it, it'll have a different flavor. Before I get to talking directly about why emptiness as a concept is really important, I have to talk a little bit about another phrase called anatta, which means not self. And it's the basic Buddhist view that contrary to our tendency or our ingrained belief, we don't have a coherent, lasting, hard personality or identity that's guiding or creating all of our thoughts and creating all of our feelings. That there's this idea in a lot of cultures that we have this soul or this this core personality that's, you know, if you're some spiritual paths have it, you know, that it's something that was created by a deity or it's something that just came about or, you know, in certain psychoanalytic circles, it could be considered to be the result of the relationships you had with your caretakers when you were really quite young that created this sort of hardly ingrained, engraved identity that sort of gives your entire life this sense of linearity and this sense of, this is who I am. I'm so-and-so. And the Buddha made two observations when it came to this idea of the self. The first is that we actually don't have one that's lasting. It actually is a, we have a self in any moment of the day. We have a personality right now. But the idea that it doesn't change or that it's pretty static or that it's pretty determined, the Buddha said, was an illusion. And the second part, even more important than the first, is that the carrying around of this idea, that all the time we spend trying to figure out who we are really, who was I in the past, what am I going to be like in the future? You know, what do other people think about me? How do I compare with other people? Who is this self inside of me? What am I really? All these thoughts and all of the activities in the mind they give birth to are stressful. They're not helpful. They're actually stressful. So first off, a little bit about why we like to think that we have a coherent identity or self. One of the reasons is that the mind is really fascinated with the world around us. And the world around us is really confusing, and there's a lot of things happening. There's a lot of things to keep track of. So it seems like it's a helpful idea, and it's also perceptually something that's very easy to believe, that what's going on inside of us, our moods, our thoughts, our feelings, are pretty consistent. And giving birth to this illusion, as well as this voice that we carry around in our head, our narrative voice. Oh, another Monday. I guess I gotta go to Dharma Punks. You know, oh, Tuesday, this isn't any better than the Monday. Whatever. Whatever the voice that we're carrying around, and it tends to, you know, we can go through long moods, but we can have an idea that, you know, there's a couple of different flavors of our personality. Sometimes I'm happy-go-lucky, and there's other times I'm depressed, and there's times that I'm funny, and there's times that I'm really quite clever. But they tend to all be different shades of the same color that we tend to believe that we have, or the same kind of inner core personality. And so when we meditate, when we stop getting all the time so caught up in the projects and the shit that's going on all around us, and we start focusing regularly within, we begin to notice, after the thoughts that are repetitive die down, after our practice gets going, we begin to really notice what the Buddha noticed 2,500 years ago, which is, wow, what I've got going on inside of me is changing. My moods are constantly slightly changing. The body feels different. The way I feel, my emotions are constantly shifting. And even this voice that I think is me, sometimes it's a little bit nagging, and sometimes it's a little bit assertive, and sometimes I'm shouting at myself, and sometimes I'm being really, you know, it's a quieter voice. So the more we let go of being overly fixated by the world, and we bring our awareness in, we begin to see, wow, it's not as singular a personality as it seems. It's actually this constant sort of seesawing flux, moving and shifting, and it's never ever returning to the same state. Because even if yesterday I'm happy and today I'm happy, yesterday's happiness has a different state of, you know, voice in the mind, is a different feeling in the body, it is a different tone, it is a different mood slightly to it. All the components to yesterday's happiness are different from today's. So we begin to see that life, rather than having these static slots that we fall into, the happy me or the sad me, it's this sort of analog shift of different flavors, and there's never any static thing there. And when we begin to see this and we let go of there's a knowable identity that summarizes who I am, then life actually becomes a lot easier. Because when we carry constantly around this inner autobiography of who we are really, and, you know, all the struggles we've had in life, where we want to become, where we want to go, all the stuff we carry around is actually a lot of effort. And, you know, we have to add all these stories about ourselves to each event. You sit down to meditate, and if you don't have all that self-storytelling, you say, ooh, there's a cushion. You can sit down. Yeah, nothing going on. Ooh, okay. Nice-looking people, you know. But if we carry around, oh, you know, the last time I meditated, it really sucked, and I've never been good at this, and, you know, my mind sometimes gets really loud, then suddenly it's like, ooh, that cushion, it's a dangerous thing. Why does he want me to sit here? This is crazy. And add that to every experience in our life. You know, we have to do something that's new. The first thing the mind says, I don't know what I'm doing. I've never done this before. Other people know what they're doing. I'm going to suck at this. You know, it's this constant adding of our story to each new situation in life. So we tend to gravitate towards, you know, sometimes things that are familiar because it gives us the sense that, oh, I'm good at that. Yes, I've ridden a bike before. I can do that. But I don't want to get near that skateboard or vice versa. So we have these, we add all this storytelling about ourselves to each new situation. And as we do this, it creates a lot of stuff we have to push through. And as we carry around also the story of, you know, keeping track of where we're going and where we believe we've been, then we have all these preferences too. You know, we have to view everything that happens at work. Is this good for me? Is that bad? There's news. Something's happened. Something's gotten fired. What does this mean about me? You know, fuck them. what? How is this going to affect my job? And is this going to make life more difficult for me? Oh no, there's somebody new here. What does he want? And then, of course, when the more self-storytelling we tell, we tend to believe that everything that's happening is happening to us. You ever have that happen where somebody's just laughing? Might be a joke that they're thinking about in their head. And you're like, why are they laughing at me? What's wrong with them? So there's almost an inherent paranoia to having a self-centered mind or a mind that thinks or, you know, processes in terms of what does this mean for me? Because we tend to think that when somebody's in a bad mood, that they're angry with us. They're not just in a bad mood. He's pissed off at me. Why is he looking at me that way? Yeah, it might not be that he didn't get enough sleep. Whatever. So it makes life so much more complicated. And it tends to keep us limited. And I tell one of the stories that I was in a yoga class with a woman who said, oh, I can't do upward facing dog. Can't do it. Just cannot do it. And the yoga teacher just said, well, what would happen if you just, you know, lift up a little there? And she said, oh, okay, sure. And what would happen if you just push this down a little bit there? And she said, oh, but I can't do upward facing dog. And the teacher said, well, you're doing it right now. But her belief was so strong that even while she was doing it, she believed that she wouldn't. She wasn't. She couldn't even perceive reality because her sense of this is what she was not capable of was so strong. And so we tend to carry this with us. So what does this have to do with emptiness? Well, I'm tying it in right now. When we hear the word emptiness or shunyata, the Buddha is, and he says all things are empty. He's not saying that things don't exist. He's not saying that there's no material things out there. What the Buddha was using with the word shunyata and why he was saying it's a very positive state, why emptiness is so positive in Buddhist writings, why in Buddhist writings they talk about the goal is to become an empty vessel, is because emptiness refers to the idea of the self. When the Buddha says we want to be empty, he says he wants us to empty out of the mind all these stories we carry around about ourselves, so that we're not emptying out thoughts, we're not emptying out the things we need to do, we're not emptying out the mind of all content. What we're doing is emptying out the mind of the stuff that causes us suffering, the sticky thoughts that give birth to what the Buddha called papancha, which is another word for obsession. In other words, if I say, you know, blah, blah, blah happened, we have two ways of taking it. If we take it just, oh, this event happened, we generally don't get too bent out of shape. But if we think it's about us, it's a statement about us, then we suddenly get very attached. Or another way of looking at it is, if I have a thought, boy, that was dumb, the action I just did. Boy, that was dumb. I can live with that. But if I have the thought, I'm dumb, I just did something stupid and it means I'm dumb, I suck, I'm a loser, that thought is not going to stop there. It's going to spiral out. I'm going to beat myself up. I'm going to suddenly, anything that says this is about me, my core, my identity, I'm going to get really, you know, I really suck. I did something dumb. And I'm going to feel small, and I'm going to feel under attack. And this is why it's so difficult for so many people to admit when we've made mistakes, because we don't learn to simply say, wow, that action, not the smartest action ever. We tend to think, oh, what an asshole, I can't believe I did that. The more self we add in, the more painful it becomes, the more painful it becomes, the more we justify our actions, because we don't want to admit that we've made a mistake, because if we believe we make a mistake, we believe it means something about us, our personality. We don't understand that everybody makes mistakes. That's the human condition. So, the Buddha, when he talked about one of the core goals of the practice is to achieve emptiness, he's not saying, oh, we're trying to come to a place where we think that nothing outside of us exists, or that nothing exists at all, which would be stupid, because things do exist. What the Buddha is wanting us to do is to come to a place where we don't get caught up in making all these identity claims about ourselves and other people. So what does that look like? You know, sometimes at work we see somebody a few times and they're difficult, and we immediately add the little moniker, oh, what an asshole. You know? Oh, there's that asshole. Oh, that, you know, that account person, that production person, that this person, that person. What an asshole. They're always giving me a hard time. They're always they're always not liking what I do. And when we do that, when we ascribe an identity, we do a couple of things. First of all, each time we see them, we have to become defensive. We have to remember that, oh no, this person is like that. We write off the possibility that they have other shades and flavors, that they're not, we don't believe that their process is unfolding. Even more important, if I believe someone's a jerk, then it will not really occur to me that the way they act is in response to the way I behave. Because I'll just believe, they're a jerk. It doesn't matter really what I do. They're a jerk. They'll just be a jerk. They're jerky. Jerky jerk. But if I instead view this person doesn't have a core inherent identity, and instead I open up to the idea that this person is just a whole lot of different thoughts, moods, feelings, processes that are changing, and that they're reacting and responding to the way I behave and to the different things that have happened to them, then I open up to the possibility of, wow, if I relate to this person in a different way than I have, maybe the way they manifest themselves to me will be different. Life becomes an exploration rather than a set of avoiding certain people that I've identified as difficult and moving towards the people I've identified as helpful. So this is one sense of how positive, in a sense, believing that people are empty can be. There's a famous metaphor that's taught in Zen schools of this, that of the boat, that the rowboat that somebody's sitting in, and you're sitting lying in this boat and you're very comfortable, and another rowboat slams into you, and we get very angry. What the fuck are you doing? You know, I'm at my rowboat. I'm relaxing, and then this whole argument, and then with spiritual practice, you look and you see there's nobody in that boat. They're just an empty vessel. They're just doing what they do. They weren't doing it to you. It's just a boat that's moving along with the, and that's what other people are. They're not doing anything to us. They're just moving with the flow of life. And there's another great example of this, monk Nagarjuna. and Nagarjuna meets the king, and the king says, Nagarjuna says something along the lines of, I can prove to you that your chariot doesn't exist. And the king's sitting in the chariot. And the king says, well, okay, I'd like to see this. So he says, Nagarjuna says, okay, get out of the chariot. And the king does. And he says, let's take it apart, bit by bit. So they take out the wheels and the axles, and I have no idea what's in a chariot, so just work with me, and the seats, and the front, and the back, and all the different parts. And they lay it out in front of the king. And so Nagarjuna goes to one piece after another. He says, okay, this wheel, is this your chariot? And the king goes, no, that's just the wheel. This axle, is this your chariot? No, that's just the axle. This seat, is this your chariot? No, that's just the seat. You see, he goes through it piece by piece, and at no point does the king ever reach a piece that is the chariot. The chariot is just an idea. It's just a way we refer to a whole conglomeration of parts. And this was the core Buddhist teaching of the way to relate to other people. They're not got this core inner mean streak or inner identity that's locked in. They're processes made up of different components, moods, ideas, things that are happening in the world, things they've heard, things they're repeating. It's just moving through them. And so we can be much more open to the possibility if there's things that will rise that are different than we expect from them. Finally, another way that emptiness is used in the Buddha's teachings that's kind of interesting is the Buddha talked about with his monks. He said that at first during the meditation they would start out with sounds and seeing the world around them. And they, when they brought the awareness into the body, then they would move their attention to all the body sensations and the thoughts. And then as the thoughts quieted down and the body relaxed, there'd be fewer sensations. And then eventually, he said, the mind would begin to open up to not the sensations in the body, but just the sensation of there being no inside and no outside, nothing really to latch the mind onto. So what was going on is in that meditation, we start out with a mind that's following the world and all the events and all the stuff that's happening, and all we're hearing all the sounds, and then as we bring the mind more and more inwards and it becomes more and more quiet, there's fewer and fewer objects to focus on. Until finally, the single object that we're focusing on, whether it's the breath or whether it's the sensation of just consciousness itself, it becomes so big that it takes over the entire attention and it no longer seems as if there's anything happening at all. And the Buddha says that rather than this being a boring state, you know, what the fuck, there's nothing on this channel, this sucks, you know, it's actually a deeply relaxing state. Obviously, in our culture, we fear actively lack of stimulation. There's this old story I read with, not too old, so kind of recent actually, about these policemen that were talking about they no longer needed in our culture to intimidate as much as they used to, or these detectives, or, you know, even threaten to obviously physically abuse people. They would simply leave them in an interrogation room for a couple of hours without any stimuli. And when they came in, people would, I'm guilty. Just take me out of here. I can't, you know, I can't, you know, give me back my iPhone. So, while I'm not really here espousing the police, God, it's interesting that we fear lack of stimuli, because I think that in a certain way we're so more comfortable now having the mind tied down to all the shit that's going on around us that the notion that being internal, being relaxed, being peaceful, it's something very, very deeply foreign. And at first, of course, it's difficult to get used to the body sensations and the moods and stuff, but the more we practice, what starts out as a difficult experience actually becomes really, really pleasant. The sensation of being in a mind that doesn't have a lot of self-centered thoughts, that's not taking every thought personally as if that's what I really am, that thought is indicative of my core identity, that's not taking anything external personally, that's not taking what other people say personally, that's not ruminating about ourselves. This is a really pleasant destination. So, that's it. I hope you find something worthwhile in that. I thank you for listening. And now it's